good afternoon. I am Matthew Caruana Galizia, and I will be presenting today's edition of It's Debatable. This is a weekly discussion of current affairs in its second series. The program is run by the Department of International Relations in the Faculty of Arts at the University of Malta as part of the course assessment for undergraduate students. Today's participating students are Stephanie McAuliffe, Andrew Caruana Galizia, Kristen Hurst, and Julian Mera. They will be discussing the ongoing armed conflict in the Darfur region of Sudan. After the break, we will have a short intervention by David Bogdan, the protection officer from the UNHCR representation in Malta. Before starting today's debate, Dr. Clayda Molay will give us an introduction to the topic.
When I first started to study Darfur, I was perplexed by the complexity of its history and ethnic composition. More than 40 ethnic groups, in total about 6 million people, live in the region. Although mostly Muslims, the people of Darfur are composed of two major blocs: indigenous Africans, who are mainly agriculturalists and live and farm in fertile areas, and the Arabs, who are mainly pastoralists and live in less fertile areas. Now, the Darfur conflict, which has made headlines in the past 4 years, has complex roots. But the role of land and national policies are crucial in understanding the present crisis. One important issue is that of land jurisdiction, since de facto jurisdiction over substantial tracts of territory is granted to large ethnic groups, but not to small ones. Consequently, the rapid using up of free cultivable land rendered land disputes more common and more bloody, especially since the 1980s. This has coincided also with the decline of the resources assigned by Khartoum to Darfur's regional government, which could not then discharge its responsibility of maintaining law and order. Moreover, misguided policies by successive governments in Khartoum, not only in terms of distribution of resources, but also in terms of encouraging Arab supremacism, were a crucial contributing factor in the outbreak of violence in Darfur. In order to fight discrimination by Khartoum, non-Arab Islamists formed the Justice and Equality Movement, whereas the elite of the largest ethnic communities of the Fur, Masalit and Zaghawa established the Darfur Liberation Front, renamed in 2003 as the Sudan Liberation Army. The latter promptly showed military capacity, looting government property and weapons. Faced with the military threat from the rebel movements, Khartoum called upon some local tribes, mostly Arabs, as well as criminal elements, to assist in the fighting against the rebels. The latter were trained and armed by the Khartoum government and then enrolled in special military formations known as Janjaweed. Responding to the threat posed by the insurgency, the government forces, in collaboration with the Janjaweed, have pursued a military strategy that deliberately targeted the civilian population sharing the ethnicity of the rebel movements through a combination of indiscriminate aerial bombardment and a scorched earth policy. Choosing to overlook the distinction between military targets and civilians and the principle of proportionality in the use of force, the government strategy has produced a catalogue of tragedy. As many as 2 million civilians have been uprooted from their homes and nearly 200,000 people have been killed by aerial bombardment and military raids. If there is a case when intervention is warranted on humanitarian grounds, Darfur seems to be it. Yet such intervention has still to happen. A heated debate has been going on whether the Darfur tragedy qualifies as genocide, in which case intervention seems more justifiable. Nevertheless, the Darfur tragedy is not a clear-cut case of genocide, given that it is problematic to prove the specific intent required for this crime. Indeed, the intent seems to be displacement of the targeted people rather than their extermination. Yet confusion with the terminology has contributed to making the conflict more intractable. In addition, disagreement on a common definition of the situation has tended to justify inaction or limited involvement on the part of the international community. So Darfur poses a poignant reminder that the puzzles of terminology need to be sorted out. There is wide agreement, however, that atrocities committed in Darfur constitute crimes against humanity. Such crimes are serious enough to require intervention. The international community should not wait for a crime to qualify as genocide before a military intervention takes place to stop it. Khartoum certainly opposes any kind of intervention under the pretext of sovereignty. Yet the conception of sovereignty has evolved to incorporate the duty of governments to protect their own people. Khartoum has surely failed miserably in this respect. The prospects of intervention itself raise challenging questions. First of all, who should conduct the intervention? The United Nations appears to have not managed so far to reach a conclusion either on mobilization of troops or funds required. Some had hoped that the African Union could assume new responsibilities over Darfur, but their force has been small and underfunded. Whereas the latter organization can still play a useful role in Darfur, it seems to me that, like in any humanitarian tragedy, what powerful states do is crucial. The great powers have the greatest responsibility to act, not least because they have the greatest capacity to act. So intervening in Darfur may be the right thing to do in order to uphold humanitarian values and dispel the criticism of hypocrisy that some see associated with the rhetoric and practice of humanitarian intervention.
Thank you, Dr. Mulai. After that introduction, Bruno Parsons, an international relations student, will read some quotes from newspapers and articles that concern today's debate.
Thank you, Matthew. My first quote is by the UN Office of Humanitarian Affairs, and it goes on saying, as far as the crisis in Darfur is concerned, we believe that the African Union, United Nations, and other sub-regional organizations share our belief that the Comprehensive Peace Agreement provides a framework for settling the crisis in Darfur. My second quote is by Kofi Annan. According to him, commercial trucks carrying humanitarian assistance, including those marked as agency or humanitarian affiliated, continue to be attacked by armed groups or on major routes, severely limiting access to populations and causing major delays in the critical timely delivery of essential items, particularly food.
Thank you, Bruno. Stephanie, what role does the Sudanese government accept or want the international community to take in the conflict?
Well, first of all, it's important to point out that the Sudanese government in the past has been willing and has cooperated with the international community. However, today there is an air of distrust between the Sudanese government and the international community, especially the United Nations. This is for many reasons. First of all, the Sudanese government is concerned that the United Nations is entering the conflict with an air of impartiality. That is, they're treating the government as the bad guys and the rebels as the good guys. This is because in the past, like especially in the 2006, there was a peace agreement which the government was willing to sign with the rebels. However, the rebels refused to sign this agreement and also vowed to treat the African Union peacekeeping troops in Sudan as their enemies, which are where they have kept, as till today there are many African Union officials going missing, many have been kidnapped, and also many deaths. Also, the Sudanese government, especially the President Omar al-Bashir, is concerned with how the United Nations and the international community treat these crises. He uses Iraq as an example. He doesn't like the way the intervention in Iraq caused a greater humanitarian crisis, especially since in Iraq 160,000 international community troops were sent. Iraq is a country one-third the size of Sudan, and in Sudan they propose to send only 22,000 troops. And the Sudanese government is not willing to cooperate with the international community unless they come up with some viable solutions to the conflict. Also, this is an internal affair, as the UN has admitted. This is not a case of genocide. And the Sudanese government would prefer to solve this conflict themselves unless, as I said before, a viable solution is proposed.
Thank you, Steffi. And what are your answers to those questions?
Well, as Stephanie has mentioned, the Sudanese government believes that this is an internal affair and does not wish to see any extra involvement from the international community. It's also objected to the conflict being labelled genocide. The government argues that this would destabilise the region, but there are other factors which need to be examined. For example, recognising that genocide is taking place would put pressure on the UN to impose economic sanctions, including sanctions on oil, which is a resource that Sudan is highly dependent on, And, well, of course the Sudanese government will object to this. But these sanctions could be a great help. They would force the government to make a choice between ending the conflict or having its important oil revenue cut, which, and it must be said, is being used to buy weapons from Russia and China. An alternative to sanctions could be bolstering the power of the African Union. This could be done by increasing its presence in the region as well as its scope. But al-Bashir has already declared himself to be against any increase in the mandate of African Union forces. This could give them the power to monitor the activities of the Sudanese police and armed forces, which could reveal incriminating evidence of abuse. It's already reported that members of the Janjaweed militia itself are being recruited into the National Police Force. While this goes on, there's no way that the police can be trusted in dealing with the rebels. The motives of the Sudanese government must be viewed with suspicion. It has very little concern for democracy and human rights, and is far from being representative of the Sudanese people. It only represents the interests of the ethnic Arabs.
Thank you, Andrew. Steffi, why do you think the UN has refrained from calling the conflict a genocide?
Well, first of all, let's define the meaning of genocide. This is the systematic killing of all the people from a national, ethnic or religious group, or an attempt to do this. This, however, is not the situation in Sudan. One cannot deny that there are terrible killings and atrocities going on in Sudan. However, the two sides, the rebel groups and the Arab militia, unfortunately are killing without discrimination of race, ethnic group or religion. And therefore, through the UN's in-depth studies, they have acknowledged that this situation is in fact not a genocide, and therefore they cannot intervene militarily.
Andrew, why do you think this is a genocide?
Well, even though I do already believe that the conflict is in fact genocide, the issue is irrelevant. Whether or not one would call the conflict genocide or not, it is still reasonable to believe that genocide is taking place or will take place. There's no use waiting around for solid proof that genocide has taken place before taking action, as that would mean that it's already too late. But the UN has its own reasons for failing to take a solid stance on the crisis. Here's the problem of the foreign economic interests in the country. One of the major economic players in the region is China, which buys most of Sudan's oil and is investing heavily in its oil industry. Now, China's hardly renowned for its respect of human rights and, in fact, does business with some of the least respectable governments of the world, with very little concern over what its money or arms are used for. If the UN were to impose oil sanctions on Sudan, China's interests would suffer. There's also Russia, which sells weapons like fighter jets and attack helicopters to Sudan. And these are obviously then used to massacre whole villages and possibly also arm the Janjaweed in aid of its rape and pillaging. The big problem is that both Russia and China are permanent members of the UN, Security Council, with a veto to block any action the UN decides to take. It's not very hard to see why that all that the UN could produce up until now were watered-down resolutions vaguely implying UN might consider further action if the situation does not get better. How can the UN defend human rights around the world if any initiatives depend on a green light from two repressive, undemocratic countries which place little value in human life, let alone human rights?
Today we are discussing the ongoing armed conflict in the Darfur region of Sudan. We have David Bogdan, the protection officer from the UNHCR representation in Malta. David, how would international crises such as that in Darfur impact on small countries like Malta in terms of immigration and refugees?
Every country in the world has been affected by a refugee crisis. States directly involved in war produced millions of displaced people in the 20th century alone. Other countries, untouched by chaos themselves, provide aid and shelter to the displaced. The roles have sometimes been reversed. Europe was awash with refugees in the aftermath of the two world wars, but is now a beacon of hope to other displaced people. In many cases, today's neighbor is tomorrow's refugee. They have lost their homes, jobs, community, and often their family. They are not a threat, but they do need temporary help until they can reestablish their lives. The situation in the Darfur region of Sudan has been described as the world's worst humanitarian crisis. Since the conflict began in 2003, an estimated 200,000 people have been killed and more than 2 million people are living in camps after fleeing fighting that has targeted civilians. Many genuine refugees flee from countries like Sudan and attempt a long and hazardous journey to find protection in Europe. Given Malta's geographic position in the middle of the Mediterranean, It sits on the preferred route of access to Europe for asylum seekers and migrants coming from the North African coast. This fact, combined with its population density, which is one of the highest in the world, has given prominence to the asylum issue and illegal immigration in Malta. Under international law, people fleeing from persecution or war have the right to apply for asylum and have access to the refugee status determination procedure in Malta, as they would in other countries of asylum. Asylum seeker is the name given to a refugee who has not yet had his or her request for a refugee status determined by the authorities. Asylum seekers that reach Malta or are rescued at sea off the coast of Malta must be allowed to remain in Malta until their request for asylum has been considered by the authorities. A very significant percentage of people requesting asylum in Malta have proven to be in need of international protection. In 1971, Malta signed the Geneva Convention relating to the status of refugees, which is the cornerstone of international protection for refugees. In practice, this protection entails trying to guarantee a refugee's basic human rights and ensuring that no person will be returned involuntarily to a country where he or she has reason to fear persecution. Malta is one of 146 states that have signed the Refugee Convention, guaranteeing protection to refugees that reach their territory. In 2000, Malta passed the Refugees Act, regulating the status of asylum seekers on its territory and creating the Office of the Refugee Commissioner, which is responsible for the determination of refugee status. The Refugees Act describes the refugee status determination procedure in detail and sets out the rights accorded to refugees and asylum seekers in Malta. Asylum seekers arriving in Malta present an asylum application to the Commissioner upon their arrival. The Commissioner then sets an appointment for them to be interviewed to assess their request for asylum. Undocumented asylum seekers are generally kept in closed reception centers until a positive decision on their status is taken, or for a maximum of 18 months. In the 3 years after its creation in 2002, the Refugee Commissioner examined the asylum requests of 3,205 individuals. In 2006, 181 people from Sudan applied for refugee status in Malta, and 138 were granted protection and allowed to remain in Malta. The United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, known by its acronym UNHCR, was created by the UN General Assembly in 1950 to lead and coordinate efforts to protect refugees. UNHCR is actively engaged in advising the Maltese authorities on their response to asylum seekers and refugees, and, in particular, to guarantee that genuine asylum seekers are given protection in Malta. UNHCR continues to provide advisory support to the process for determining whether or not people arriving in Malta are refugees. For example, UNHCR provides the Refugee Commissioner with up-to-date information on the situation in Darfur, which enables the authorities to assess a person's need for protection and to determine whether or not it would be safe for them to return to Sudan. As the number of displaced people has increased dramatically worldwide over the past 50 years, many states have remained willing to help civilians fleeing conflicts, but only on a temporary basis. The great majority of today's refugees would themselves prefer to return home once the situation normalizes. Where possible, UNHCR encourages voluntary return to a refugee's homeland if conditions warrant. When it is sometimes impossible for civilians to go home, UNHCR encourages governments to help them to integrate where they first sought asylum or facilitates their permanent resettlement to a safe third country. If a refugee does stay in his or her country of asylum for whatever reason, he or she can often become a valuable asset to a community. UNHCR recognizes Malta's particular constraints in receiving and hosting large numbers of refugees and is working with the authorities to explore ways in which the responsibility of protecting refugees can be shared, including through local integration and resettlement to other countries. As the world has become smaller because of improved communications and transportation, refugee crises like the current situations in Darfur and Iraq have moved closer to countries unaffected by the violence. The scale of the continuing state of emergency in Darfur requires a truly international response, both in ending the conflict to prevent further displacement and meeting the needs of the people already displaced by the fighting. The ongoing violence in many parts of the world makes it impossible for refugees to return there, and countries like Malta must continue to offer protection to persons fleeing persecution and war in accordance with its international obligations towards refugees. Some countries have shown remarkable solidarity by sheltering tens of thousands of refugees despite their very limited resources, while others have reacted with alarm. In such a climate, accurate information is essential to understanding the importance of international protection for refugees and addressing the fear that often accompanies asylum issues. If you are interested in finding out more information on refugees in Malta or elsewhere, you can contact the UNHCR office in Malta or visit our website at www.unhcr.org.
Thank you, Mr. Bogdan, for your comments. We can now continue with the discussion. Kristen, being from the United States, why do you believe that your country has remained marginally involved up till now?
Well, I think the lack of action on the part of the U.S. is very surprising, especially considering the course that the Bosnian conflict took in the 90s. During that genocide, the European community wanted to handle resolving the conflict on its own, which rightly so, I think, considering that it was within Europe. But after 4 years of no progress, no resolution, pressure from the international community started to mount, and the U.S. finally had to intervene militarily. It now looks as if the international community and the U.S. are planning on taking the same course of action in Darfur, or rather we should call it lack of action. The U.S. has recently imposed sanctions in an attempt to prompt action on the part of the Sudanese government. But as we saw in Bosnia, these sanctions are very ineffective. This past February, just 1 month ago, is the four-year mark since the beginning of the crisis in Darfur. And so far, all that's happened is we have a peacekeeping mission in the UN and a largely ineffective African Union. And after the genocides in Bosnia, Rwanda, and Kosovo, as the international community as a whole said never again to genocide, but with everything else that's going on in the world, the conflict in Israel, along with Iraq, Afghanistan, and Iran's nuclear program growing, unfortunately Darfur has just been pushed to the side as these other issues are dominating the headlines. The U.S. was ultimately responsible for ending the crisis in Bosnia, but currently they have these other missions going on, and their resources are stretched, and for them right now, Darfur, unfortunately, just is not a military priority. Our former U.S. Defense Secretary Colin Powell was the first political figure who went into Darfur, saw what was going on, and called it a genocide. And at that point, I think everyone in the international community expected the U.S. to intervene and do something, but as we've seen, that's still yet to happen, unfortunately.
Julian, from a Canadian perspective, how would you explain the U.S.'s foreign policy?
I would say that from a Canadian perspective, that the United States, if it has no personal interest in the issue at hand, they will not go in. Even from another North American perspective, we have the same view, and it's just an example just happened recently in Mogadishu, where they went back and they bombed the building, and they were trying to get a suspected terrorist who is part of Osama bin Laden's clan out, but instead killed 10 children and never even came close to getting him. It had nothing to do with anything. They weren't trying to suppress the Islamic militants from getting out of Somalia and trying to take over it with the Ethiopian troops. They just came in and did their business and left. It seems that they're just too preoccupied and they have committed way too much to Iraq and other places such as Afghanistan, that they are not able to mobilize troops in order to get people. In Sudan, it is not a factor. If there's nothing there such as oil or any other things, they will not go back in, because it already occurred in 1993 in Mogadishu, and they said they would probably not do it again because it cost them too much for them not having any output or input on anything that has occurred. Secondly, just quickly, I think that the population needs to be more knowledgeable about what is happening. It seems that some Americans, definitely a lot, are involved and do know about it, but there seems to be a disconnected effect that does occur in North America, even in Canada sometimes, that occurs where something happens across the world and in which a million people might die, but it seems like only 10 people die when you read it in Canada or in the United States. It just seems like it's just a disconnected effect, that it doesn't affect us as much as it does locally, which would happen in Europe, where it has much more effect.
Thank you. Kristen, if the United States can't really be trusted to take humanitarian action, who do you think should be responsible for this action?
And I'm going to give a very cookie-cutter response, but it's my personal feeling. I really do think we live in a connected world, both socially and economically. And every organization, every country, every NGO that can help in situations where, you know, genocide or any type of crime against humanity is occurring, they have an obligation to step up and do something. You know, these people need to be helped, even if they are halfway across the world. So I think, logically, organizations that have the means and the power to make a change, you know, closest to what's going on, like, you know, say Africa is Europe's neighbor. Obviously, Europe, if you can do something, go ahead. And then if they need help, call on other organizations. But it's everyone's responsibility to help out.
Okay. Julian, what do you think?
For me, it seems that the Sudanese government and the international community have failed to protect the people in the Western Sudanese region from war crimes and crimes against humanity. There's been killing, rape, torture, arbitrary arrest, repression of political dissent, and abuses of political freedoms, which occur in chilling frequency. This comes to the question now, who should be responsible for humanitarian help of any sort in Sudan? First, I'll read a quote from Tony Blair, who just recently on Thursday announced this. And even he doesn't even know, and he's part of the UN Security Council, with England and the other five. He stated that they should take a far tougher line against Sudan over atrocities in Darfur to prevent extremism spreading across Africa. Tony Blair stated that I would today take a far tougher line on Sudan, reaffirming his links of worldwide links of global terrorism. And at this point, he asked if he was sending any British troops in with this statement. And at this point, he stated that I don't think that we are able to send troops in, but certainly I think the international community should be. Which raises a very good point of exactly what are they trying to say. And this is exactly what the international community is stumbling upon. They're just bumbling around and not really knowing what to do. When he is part of the international community himself as one of the most powerful nations in the world. This comes to mind that I believe that the United Nations definitely needs to step in, because if Britain, already a powerful entity, does not really know that they should send people, they're probably, just like the United States, too busy, far busy, somewhere else in the world, taking on terrorism. But this is another sort of terrorism in the world that is happening. It's just a localized version where genocide is happening. We should not let happen what happened in Rwanda a long time ago. In order for United Nations to work, the U.S. has to have a backing, and the powerful countries of the Security Council have to show exactly that they are committed and that they are ready to organize something, because if people are stumbling around, it will not work. So the U.S. and Britain definitely need, as the most powerful, definitely need to have some sort of money backing, financial aid, to back the United Nations to do this, because or else it will not work. Now, the African Union definitely needs to be involved, since it is in Africa. But they should be run by the United Nations and funded by the United Nations, since the African Union is almost just completely depleted, where some people, soldiers, don't even get salaries there. They definitely need to be pushed by the U.S., and then through an intermediary of the United Nations, the African Union should definitely come in.
Thank you, Julian. I'd also like to thank Andrew, Kristen, and Stephanie for your comments, and Bruno Parsons for his research, and Clayton Molay and Mr. Bogdan for their contributions. I hope you enjoyed today's debate. Please join us for the next edition of It's Debatable, during which we will be discussing women in international relations.